This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. And this episode of Out of School is sponsored by DisplayNote. More about them as the show goes on, or you can visit them right now at displaynote.com. So how are you doing, Bradley?
It's good. We are recording on a Sunday for once. First, if you're listening on the podcast feed, as everybody is, but me and you, it is probably Thursday, but I will be traveling this week, taking a class. So it's different. I'm at home. I'm usually at work, so I kind of feel less stressed out recording on a Sunday.
Yep, and ignore any noises off, I think, because I don't know about your family, but my family are still roaming about in here, so there may be a few bumps and noises from behind.
It's, of course, I don't know if, I guess I'm assuming most of the listeners know that you and I are 5 hours apart in terms of time zone. So it is 2 o'clock where I am at in the afternoon. So my son is taking a nap and then my wife, I believe, is actually taking a nap as well. She's been a bit under the weather here in for the past week. And so they're both taking a nap. So I've turned off turned the air conditioner up a little bit and it is perfectly quiet in my house for the moment.
Okay. We'll see how long that lasts. Okay. So what are we going to talk about today?
Differences between enterprise and education network management from an IT perspective.
And I guess we're going to roll in from there. The next topic we've talked about doing was looking at bring your own device and the implications of that.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, I think the two are definitely related.
Well,
which I think is interesting about this topic.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about how does the new iPhone affect your Wi-Fi and your BYOD deployment. And I think mainly that's been mentioned because this is the first time that the iPhone is a 5 gigahertz wireless device. And so that does have real implications. If you have a network that is already not set up properly, then this new iPhone may tax it even more as it tries to move to a 5 gigahertz network that if your wireless network doesn't handle that properly already, could be even interesting. And so while this topic is just going to get bigger, this is a big hot button issue today, but you really think 10 to 15 years out, this may be all we have is BYOD.
Could be. I mean, I think one of the things about phones in particular is it's very easy to forget about the phones. You build your network and you think, well, I've got this many desktop computers, this many notebooks roaming about, this many iPads. Oh, and everybody's got a phone as well, and they all want those in the Wi-Fi. So the phones are very easy to forget to count.
Well, and I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, even a DHCP lease, set up, you may only have one device per person, then maybe two. I mean, certainly two was the max. Maybe if somebody did have one of those old Microsoft tablets. But I look at my office, and there are some employees, we have three. Every day they will bring in a laptop, a phone, and an iPad, and they expect all of those to get on Wi-Fi. And so just from a DHCP standpoint, like when we do DHCP on our firewall, and the model we have has a limit of about 1,000 addresses. And, there are days I get closer to that than I would like. So when we go to replace that, I'm going to have to maybe look at trying to triple that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I had a situation about 6 months ago where we, halfway through the year, for various reasons, we swapped two classrooms around. So kids in one class went into the other room. And then immediately after that, I got a call from the teacher in the next room saying, hey, the Wi-Fi's died. What's going on here? And I added it up and it was, okay, there was more kids in the new class, but it was also that we had put two teachers in that classroom, and they had brought along their laptop, they'd brought along their tablet, they'd brought along their phone. One of them actually had their Kindle with them as well, which was going on the Wi-Fi. So it rapidly became clear that we were starting to overload the base station in that area and had to do some work on it.
Well, because if I'm remembering correctly, aren't the airport extremes limited to 50 users per access point?
Yeah, they're limited to 50. We've seen practically about up to, I think I saw 46 devices in my classroom one day, and the Wi-Fi was starting to strain pretty badly at that. But that's not bad as a proportion of the stated maximum. A lot of devices do much worse than that.
No, and that's where, kind of piggybacking off our talk last week about Aerohive, and that's one of the things that I've found they've done really well is with their band steering. Because let's say you do have a class of 15 iPads, but also some of them you have maybe 10 laptops. those are all obviously 5 gigahertz devices. But what you don't want to do is just move all of those devices to 5 gigahertz, and then mm-hmm. you overload that part of your network. You want to be able to separate those out and move some of the iPads to 2.4, some of the Macs to 5, and just have an even distribution. And that's one of the things they do really well, where a lot of vendors I've read, they will talk about band steering, but that means they're just moving everything to 5. But you don't want to move it all to 5 and then leave 2.4 empty.
Absolutely. You're losing a good part of your capacity there if you don't share it out.
What was your background before you worked at Cedars?
Yeah, so I used to work on, I worked in the Large Hadron Collider project. That was my first job out of university. Was the role was called the Tier 2 Technical Coordinator. And for those people who are not intimately familiar with the computing infrastructure for the Large Hadron Collider, the way it was structured was that CERN, the laboratory in Geneva, was Tier 0. And that's where all the main data was captured, obviously, from the collider and then stripped. And then it would be sent to the Tier 1 center in every country. And in the UK, that was the Rutherford Appleton Lab in Oxfordshire. And then there was a number of Tier 2 organizations all around the country, one of which was called ScotGrid, which is where I worked, that was based in Glasgow and Edinburgh universities and the University of Durham in the north of England. And I was the guy whose job it was to coordinate the deployment between all three of those organizations. So we were dealing with basically clusters, large clusters of 100 to 150 CPUs and multiple terabytes, tens of terabytes of disk each. And what we were doing there was very interesting, because it's really bizarre to say that my experience working in the Large Hadron Collider prepared me to do an iPad deployment at a little school. But it did, because what we were doing there was we were basically doing something very, very dangerous to the university's network, which was we were taking not only data from unknown places in the world, but also we were allowing people to send us executable code that would run on our machines on the campus network. And ultimately, yes, we could trace who the code belonged to, but it wasn't a job that you could do in 2 seconds. That was going to be an investigation job after the fact if anything went wrong. So we spent a lot of time setting up, you know, demilitarized zone parts of the network, DMZs, so-called, and trying to segment the network in such a way that it was safe for us to have this area where people could share the computing resources versus the campus network, where everybody was, everything was very controlled. You know, there was VLANs for public Wi-Fi. Well, there was a little bit of public Wi-Fi at the time, but then there was also campus controlled labs and things where you couldn't plug in anything unless the MAC address was known to the computing center and so on and so on. So we were kind of off on the side doing this experimental thing with networking at the time. And I guess that kind of feeds into thinking about things like BYOD. And, you know, that was bring your own code and run it on our computers. But now we're talking about bring your own device and put it on our network. Not so different.
Well, and I think that my background is telecommunications. So after I got out of school, I worked for a local telephone company here near my house for about 5 years. And it was very much a traditional enterprise environment. And I think both of our backgrounds probably lend us some different perspective on the education model and really just how different it is. Because when I was at that job, you went in the morning, you logged into your computer, you had Outlook and you had Office, and then you had Internet Explorer. And you know, they controlled the homepage. There was no, I want to use Chrome. Of course, Chrome didn't exist at the time, but you didn't use Firefox. You didn't use Safari. You didn't, you know, decide when you wanted a new version of Windows. They rolled it out for you. It was very much a workstation style model. You had basically no control over anything. It was very much a structured Active Directory environment. You used Microsoft Exchange. Of course, this was before the days that smartphones were very big, but I did have a Trio. It was a Trio 700W. It was one of the few Windows Trios they had. And it wasn't a bad device. It was a great email device, but you couldn't do much else on it. But they even preloaded my contacts for me. And so when a new employee would come in, I would get their contact preloaded into my phone. So there was really I had no control over any of these devices. And that really is just kind of flies in the face of how I run my network now, where I give my users complete control over, you know, things like if, you know, if they don't want to have all the teachers in their address book, that's fine. They don't have to.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of this really feeds into the fact that, you know, people are different now. We are, what, 15 years into the consumer internet. We are, you know, 20 odd years into people having their own computer. I mean, this is the thing about when you get back to talking about one-to-one, I find it strange that people talk about one-to-one as being this amazing new frontier that we're just getting to, when in fact, in the real world outside of schools, we broke through the one-to-one barrier 20 years ago, to be honest with you. You know, that was, I think it was 1994, 95 was the first time that I had a computer to myself. And if I had been older, then I would probably have had one sooner, for sure.
Well, I was actually, when you say 1994, that struck a bell with me. I was on LinkedIn this morning, and I had connected with an old friend on there, and I was reading over his work history, and he was working for a hospital, and it said 94 to 96, and he said that we transitioned the doctors to having email addresses, or you know, something of that nature. Mm. And that blows my mind to think about your work pre-email.
Yeah, yeah. And this is where, when you think about BYOD again and staff having computers and freer access to the internet, I can't imagine what it would be like for somebody to come from another job and come into the standard education system and just be so cut off from sources of information during their workday. I sometimes wonder, how do people be professionals at their job without that kind of extra access to the internet?
It's
very difficult.
I don't know. I was thinking about that today as well. My father-in-law is a dentist, and my wife and I clean his office on the weekends. That's kind of our fun money. And so I was cleaning his office earlier today, and I thought about what's it like for him that he's not in front of a computer all day, doesn't have a phone with him at all during the day. He is basically in somebody's mouth the entire day. And so, you know, him and I are both big Georgia football fans. And so there'll be a suspension or something throughout the day, and I'll text him at 10 a.m. and he won't see it until 5:30 or 6 o'clock that night because he doesn't look at his phone. For his job, if his hands aren't in somebody's mouth, he's not making any money.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of it is a different environment when you're basically not connected to technology all day.
Yeah. Strange how the world's going, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I feel like I'm very lenient with our staff. That if they want to use Chrome, that's fine. If they want to use Firefox, that's fine. If they want to use Evernote, that's great. If they want to use Pages, that's fine. We let them. We don't have a structured lesson plan format. Our concern is that they're great teachers, and if they want to build a Pages template, that's great. If they want to do it all in text edit, that's fine too. And that really is just so different from the traditional enterprise model where, again, it was you did everything in Word or Excel or PowerPoint. That was if you wanted another application, you had to ask and it had to come down from a VP, and then somebody in IT had to come install it. I mean, it was just, that seems so weird to me at this point where I don't know if that's the difference between the PC and the Mac. I don't know.
I think to a certain extent, it could also be, the software you named there, those are all very expensive applications to license, you know, the Office Suite and so on. And I wonder, you know, when you talked about the kind of software that your teachers use, things like Evernote, you know, I don't know that we've had such a time before where software has been so cheap and free that, you know, and there's more to say about that, but let me finish this idea first that, so much software and so many capabilities are now available for free to people that you don't have to so tightly control the installation because it's not like you're running up costs all the time whenever somebody tries something new. It's not like, oh, I want to try using, Acrobat 9 or something. Can you give me $200 to go and get the license for that? I'm making those numbers up, but whatever it is, you know, it's not like you have to put money every single time somebody wants to try a piece of software. There's now tons of software that's available to demo and then to buy. And you know, even some of the best applications in iOS only cost, you know, $2, $3, you know, even the whole iOS iWork suite. What's that, you know, $30 total compared to what you used to pay for things like Microsoft Office. That's one thing. And I was going to say the other thing is that with the advent of app stores, you now have, you can kind of give up on having to police licensing. At least on iOS devices, I know there are ways you can move around Mac App Store purchases, but on iOS, if an application has been installed on an iOS device, assuming you're not doing a shared Apple ID model, then you know for a fact that those applications have been correctly licensed and you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Because the only software that we, I guess, provide for every computer in our organization that that is paid is Office. And of course, I really don't see how enterprises are still budgeting for this, because I think for an enterprise, I believe it's over $300 per seat for the full blown Office, where we have the education edition, we only pay about $52. Mm-hmm. But it's still kind of a nightmare to keep track of that. There's really no good, there's really no great system for that, especially on the Mac. I think on the PC side, there's a little bit more things you can do. But basically, mm-hmm. the way we buy new copies of Office is we buy our Office through a company, it's called CDWG. And then I basically email my rep and say, hey, I need to buy 5 copies of Office 2011 for Mac, put it on this credit card that he's already got on file, just give him the last 4 digits, and then he processes it. And then I go and download, or I've already got the actual download already done. Basically, Microsoft just adds 4 to my total, I guess. And mm-hmm. But yeah, everything else, it's App Store driven. And one of the things I've noticed, and I don't know that if your teachers are this way, but our teachers are used to spending a little bit of their own money on classroom supplies. And so mm-hmm. like if they wanted, no, we give them an allotment every year, but if they want something cool for the room, a lot of times they just buy it. Just mm-hmm. as if there's a cool application that I want, a lot of times I just buy it out of my own money and don't worry about it. And I've started to see that teachers are spending a little bit of their own money on applications. So if they want an app for their iPad, that even though it's their personal iPad, but they're going to use it for work, they just buy it. And I could see that trend growing too, just as if you want a pretty cool pen for your office, you just buy it.
Absolutely. And I think this also kind of feeds back into the conversation we had last week, which was, given how much teachers do for us for free and out their own pocket, who are we to kind of say, well, you must not spend a minute on Facebook in the whole school day?
I agree.
Yeah. So I guess those are some of the kind of enterprise deployment issues. And the whole, I guess the meat of this episode we were going to talk about was the idea of bring your own device to schools, which is an idea that's certainly gaining in popularity. I don't know about in the US, but certainly in the UK, it's being seen as, in some quarters, it's being seen as the only possible way forward for IT provision in the school. And I'm not totally in love with the idea. But I'm also aware that there are many subtle gradations of what do we actually mean by bring your own device. And I think it's worth, before we can get into discussing the pros and cons of this, to actually lay out what those possible options are, right? So the first idea in bring your own device is, I think this is what I understand most people to mean by bring your own device, is bring anything that looks like a computer and we will make it work. And to me, that's terrifying as an idea, to be honest with you, because I think that, well, we'll get into talking about some of the drawbacks of that model in a little minute. But another way you could cut BYOD is to say, you go and buy the device. We're going to specify what the device either is or is capable of doing, and then we'll take it from there. And there are certain difficulties in that as well. I mean, if you say, well, bring your own device, but it's got to be at least an iPad 2. Then that's a pretty high specification to set, but it does at least give you a lot of the benefits of having a school-provided one-to-one situation. But you don't necessarily have to find the money for every single iPad yourself. Again, there's some questions around that, but if you specify, you know, the last level is, there's a phrase that was invented this year. I forget who invented it, but the idea of not bring your own device, but bring a browser. So bring any device that can go on the web. And I think really that sort of cuts to the heart of the bring your own device discussion, is what people really mean when they say bring their own device is bring something that lets us all go on the web together. And that may be actually both the lowest common denominator, but also eventually the highest possible limit of what you can do when you have a situation where the school doesn't actually control all the devices that are being used for learning.
Well, you kind of control, you say, look, we're going to use Google Apps and Evernote are an example. You need to bring a device that can work with those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can kind of build a meta platform on top of the platform. and that's possible. But I think one of the things I've seen where that can go wrong is where you build a platform that is entirely web-based. But as we know, I think it's not unfair to say that pure HTML5 solutions have not really given, they've not really performed in the way that people want them to perform on mobile devices so far. And I guess the poster child for that is Facebook's recent deployment or rollback from HTML5 on the mobile devices back to native clients because they weren't really working out for them.
Yeah, it's funny. The social network that we've all loved for years, Twitter, is moving directly towards that HTML5 model. It feels like their new iPad app is just simply a web view of their mobile Twitter.com.
Yeah.
But when you look at things like that, that's where an app like Evernote for me is wonderful. And of course, you know, they're rolling out their Evernote for Business option this year. And I believe they've already got an Evernote for Education platform. Mm-hmm. That's where apps like that to me are great because they are kind of everywhere. They have a Kindle Fire app. They work on the web. They've got an iPad app, an iPhone app. And so it is a web-based platform, but with native applications. And that, to me, is where Google Docs kind of, I guess, Drive at this point kind of falls down, is because they kind of have a terrible iPad setup.
Yeah. And same thing even with Dropbox. You know, and that's not even Dropbox's fault so much as it's just there's a real impotence mismatch between the way Dropbox works and the way things like iOS want to work with the sandboxing and the applications and so on. But I think we should probably do a whole episode on Evernote at some point. I know I recently did some consulting with a school in Glasgow where we put Evernote at the heart of the whole deployment. They'd got some iPads. They also had a whole number of netbooks. And they, because it was a private language school, what they got was they got students who were coming to university in Glasgow would come 6 months early and they would brush up their English in the language school and then they would go to university and they would carry on their studies. So what they had was a very transitory student population where people could come in with any device, spend maybe 4 to 6 weeks there, and then they would go away again. And what we did for them was we put Evernote right at the heart of their deployment, so the students could log into their iPad with Evernote, they could log in from their own device with their Evernote account, or they could log in from one of the school's netbooks with Evernote, and they could all get to the same data. Now, that worked very well for them because the way they were using technology in their teaching was an exact fit for what you can do in Evernote. And I think the problem with all of these platforms, whether it be Evernote or something on the web or Google Docs or whatever, is that sometimes you will want to do something in your teaching that isn't completely supported by that platform. And I mean, this is true of every computer, but I think whenever you limit yourself so tightly to one of these meta platforms, if you like, you know, say I want to do an animation. Well, how do I do an animation and integrate that with Evernote? Right? You eventually step outside the capabilities of that platform, and then you're starting to get into fragmentation again. So all of these things, whenever you have a multi-platform strategy, you put a very tight boundary around what you can do with the device, because whatever platform or meta-platform you're using to smooth away those cross-platform differences, that platform has to either provide absolutely the union of every other platform that you want to use, or you've limited yourself to some maximum thing you can do and bring everybody along with you.
Well, I kind of ran into that earlier last week. Some of our teachers went up to Knoxville, Tennessee for a iPad in a classroom event at I don't remember the name of the school, but I guess it's not important. But I got just all kinds of text messages all day. Hey, this looks like a great application. We're going to look at this. Which I'm all for looking for new apps to use. I had a text from one of our fifth grade teachers that she said, hey, they're using Edmodo for test taking. I want to look into doing that. And of course, that sounds great. And I don't want to be the guy that says no to everything, but also I don't want to just do things, you know, I guess for one classroom like that, where, because my question is, okay, well, who sets up the accounts? Well, if they forget their password, if the students forget their passwords, who's responsible for that? We need to plan through things like that rather than just on a Friday decide, okay, Google Docs doesn't do test taking well. Let's find this other service. Well, then we've got to create a whole bunch of new accounts. We've got to keep those in sync. And we've got who does the training. Then you got another app to keep up with in case there's an OS update. And so you just have to be careful when you do kind of max out, say, an Evernote or a Google Docs, of looking at another service, don't just do it. Find one that meets one need, but find something that can meet five or six more needs.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe we should step back a little bit, and that's certainly a massive issue, is how do you overcome those cross-platform differences? But I mean, I guess the question at the heart of this is, well, why is anybody suggesting this is a good idea? And I think one of the reasons why people are suggesting this is a good idea is because, well, we're all skint. Nobody's got any money. So bring your own device does actually have the benefit of getting more and newer technology into schools. I mean, the rationale is very often, well, the kids have got these devices anyway. The schools either can't or won't decide what to do about this, or they just don't have the money to do it. Therefore, let's let the kids bring in whatever they've got, and we will use that in the classroom, right? So what they're saying there is essentially that parents can afford to keep up with technology, but the schools can't, right? That may or may not be true. I mean, one of the things that actually inspired us to do our iPad deployment was I asked the kids in our school, and don't forget, the Cedars is, of course, a quote-unquote rich private school, that I asked the students, I said, well, pull out your phones, show me what you've got. And this was 2 years ago. And there was one or two kids with hand-me-down Blackberries from a few years before, kids with feature phones, kids with no phone, and one or two kids with older iPhones. It absolutely was not the case that everybody was carrying the latest smartphone, and I don't believe that's true even now. But another thing that some people will argue is actually good about bring your own device is that it provides a heterogeneous technology environment so that you have multiple platforms in the classroom. Now, of course, number one on my list of drawbacks of BYOD right here is also it provides a heterogeneous technology environment, because as you and I know, and I'm sure Andy, who has tried to deploy such an environment, is that that is in many ways like the worst possible thing you could think to do.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we struggle with is when do we make it? Because we've talked about one-to-one heavily. We had multiple discussions last week. And since we stop at fifth grade, we are constantly thinking of what happens when they leave here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they go to another school, are we asking them to buy a device for our school that doesn't work at the next school? Of course, you don't have to worry about that because you go all the way through. And then there's a history of why we don't go to high school, which is a topic probably nobody in Chattanooga cares about, that's outside of Chattanooga cares about. It's a very long, very long story. But I don't know. We just struggle. We talk about this often, and we don't really have a great answer for that. And I think that's the disadvantage of us being a school that stops at fifth grade.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that this is a simple thing to do. I mean, it's going one-to-one or not going one-to-one is very difficult. But I think my concern with BYOD is that it kind of is like a fake one-to-one, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to provide most of the promise of one-to-one, but with none of the hardship, right? And the hardships in one-to-one are things like planning, expertise, training, organization, you know, all the disaster recovery planning, all that kind of stuff, because there are so many questions. I mean, if you think about what it would be like to be a teacher and stand up in front of a BYOD class, right? You've got 25 to 30 children in front of you. Every single one of them's got a device. You have no idea what any of them are. You don't know which operating system any of them run. You don't know what patch level they're on, what generation of the operating system they're on. You don't know what the application purchasing setup is for any of those devices. Some children will have devices that do not have any applications on them. Some people will have inherited BlackBerry devices. Someone's parents will have gone to Toys R Us and bought them a $40 Android tablet that runs Android 2. You know, some people will have gone to the HP Fire Shield and got them a touchpad for $50 or $100 or whatever it was. And they're not only that, right? That's bad enough, but you can maybe get a handle on that on the first day. But then the next problem is everybody gets something new for their birthday. So not only do you have a heterogeneous technology environment, hardware and software to start with, but then it is also uncontrolled. You cannot test anything on it beforehand. You can't administer it in any way. And it is also constantly changing. Now, to my mind, the only worst thing could be if they were all on fire. I don't know how anybody would be happy to handle that problem. And I think what this really does, what BYOD really does, is it tries to take the cost of doing ICT and it buries it in two places. It buries it in the parents' pocket for a start. But secondly, it buries the cost of what people like you and I do for our schools. And it takes that cost away and says, well, we don't have to do all that ICT stuff. And it buries all that cost in the cost of teacher time and effort.
Well, here's an even a simpler problem. Okay, so let's say in a perfect BYOD setup, let's say you have a school that, you know, day one, you have to have the iPad 3. And let's even say you have to have a 3G 64 gigabyte. So even if the school's internet goes down, we all have internet, right? You think there's nothing that can go wrong there. Okay, so let's say Monday you're going to have a so again, the school owns no devices. They only provide the wireless infrastructure. But again, if that fails, all the students have their own 3G network or 4G or LTE, depending on what country you're in. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have a test on Monday morning that is taken on the iPad. On the way to school, a kid drops and breaks his iPad. What do you do?
Yeah.
You have no spares because the school doesn't own any. And how does the kid take the test? And so even if it's under warranty and Apple's going to fix it for $99, it still has to be sent off and still takes a week.
Yep.
And how do, I mean, and you know, and again, a situation like a one-to-one, you typically will overbuy. So you'll have some spares that, if in your situation, a kid breaks an iPad, theoretically, they could bring it to you and you could restore it.
Yeah, that's a one-hour turnaround for me. Because I've got a spare right here. I mean, in many proposed BYOD situations, what a lot of people say is, well, kids who've got them, bring them, and the school will provide ones for those who can't afford it, right? So the school will typically have some of something, but here's the question, right? Say the school buys Kindle Fires, right, because they're £129 over here. The school's got a stock of spare Kindle Fires, but the child who drops their thing is using an iPad, right? And you've got to do some learning with that child that day. Can you give them a Kindle Fire and have them pick up from where they left off? Well, yes, you can, but only if you have pushed everybody off the native platform onto some meta platform on the web, right? So I think whenever you dance around BYOD, I think what I always find it comes back down to is we're going to get everybody on the web. And that ends up being the kind of, not just the goal, but also the limiting factor in what you do. Because if you can't smooth away these platform differences with the web, then you've got a confusing situation for your teachers.
Yeah. Ultimately, people like you and me, we can tinker. But yeah. I think of it just like the joke I made a few weeks ago. If I have to tell my teachers about VPN, they will not stay with me. They ultimately just want to teach. And if technology can make that better, then they're all for it. But if it slows them down, they're not going to do it. Perfect example is, do you guys use any digital whiteboards, Promethean or Smart or either one of those?
We have them hanging on the wall. Let's put it that way.
I guess a one-to-one with iPad, that they're really not that much use. But we've got three Promethean boards. We've got a traditional one that's mounted on the wall, and then we've got two of their, mobile boards, but I wouldn't call them portable because they're incredibly heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
but they're on wheels or something?
They are on wheels, and it has a short throw projector on it. And so we have one for our hallway that's second and third grade, and then we have one that's fourth and fifth grade. And then we have another one in what we call our science lab. That's when they do dissections and things like that. That's where our classes go.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been having a huge issue with them really for the past year where they just wouldn't connect to the Mac. You would plug it up and the projector part would work, but the USB connection would work 2 out of 5 times. And I've had our vendor out here multiple times, and it will work half of the time. And they are kind of at a loss. They always give us a new driver to try, and it really never works, doesn't fix the problem. And, of course, we're still running Snow Leopard, so I know it can't be an OS issue. Well, again, a lot of our teachers have have been so frustrated with them because they have to, when they go in to use them, they end up calling me ahead of time just so I can hook it up right and make sure it works. And if it doesn't work, so I can fix it. And it just got to where they were so frustrated with it, they couldn't count on it, so they just didn't use it. So they, you know, we have these boards that it cost $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a piece that weren't being used because the teachers didn't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had our vendor out again this last week, and we think we got to the root of the issue. They replaced some of the back end cabling that they felt was a little long. It was some USB cords that were longer than they really should have been from the get go. So they fixed those. They've moved us over to a wireless connection for the connection to the board. These little receivers, and it seems to have worked much better since then. And we'll see. But I say all that to say, teachers don't want to tinker.
No, they don't.
If we were doing show titles, I think that would be the name of the show. Teachers don't want to tinker, but they just want it to work. And when they get errors and when they have syncing issues, they get frustrated. They're already so busy. They're overworked. They've got a lot of stress on them. And you know, whether it's a pen to a pencil, whether it's an iPad stylus, they just want it to work the first time.
Yeah. I mean, my rule of thumb for this kind of thing is that you get two chances. Right? Teachers will try something one time. If it fails, they'll give you a chance to fix it. They'll try it again. But if they lose their lesson twice in a row in front of a class, I don't really think, in fact, I know for a fact that that's pretty much the limit. Unless you've got an enthusiast teacher, and let's face it, most teachers are not tech enthusiasts. I mean, most people in the world are not tech enthusiasts. You're pretty much done. You know, that's, as far as I can tell, that's how many chances I get with technology is two. And if I fail twice, then that's that.
You know, one of the, and I may get in trouble for saying this, and I think most of us, I guess, recognize that typically the newer teachers that are younger are a little bit more excited about technology because they've kind of grown up with it. Would you not agree?
I think that's true. I think there are some modifications to that when you get to one-to-one. But yeah, in general, that's what people seem to think.
And so what always has hurt me is like one of our most excited teachers about technology and who did a lot of training, she would go and help other teachers and she was wonderful. Well, her and her husband are having a baby, so she didn't come back this year. I'm thinking, no, please come back. You're one of my best teachers with technology training. You've got to come back. So that's more of a joke. But, you know, of course, again, I think as time goes along, I hope that teachers will view technology not as an add-on, but more as part of as just what they do with teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would certainly hope so. I mean, I think when you get into a one-to-one situation, or probably, you know, a BYOD situation is a one-to-one situation anyway, it's just a less controlled one. What I found, and I've heard this from other schools that have gone one-to-one as well, is that it's actually the younger teachers start to worry more about that situation. Because when you get up to one-to-one, what you're doing is you're giving away a lot of control in the classroom. And the older teachers, the more experienced teachers, know that they can get the classroom back whenever they need to, because they've got that experience. Whereas the younger teachers, and certainly in secondary, where young teachers are quite close in age to, say, some of the older students, that power relationship in the classroom can sometimes start to be very different when everybody's empowered with a device in their hands. And that's something we've had to learn a little bit about over the past couple of years as well.
Well, another couple of other things I had written down here on just general, you know, kind of BYOD thoughts were really this goes back to you've got to have a great Wi-Fi network, because you don't want to have just a Wi-Fi network that's not going to hold up, and then students start bringing out all these devices that maybe don't work as well with it. Well, then the whole experience really kind of goes down from there. Mm-hmm. And then really just some other things, device support policies from a support standpoint. If a student has a Kindle Fire and you've never used a Kindle Fire, what do you do mm-hmm. to support that? If it's having Wi-Fi issues, what do you do to support that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is incredibly difficult because I don't know about in the US, but certainly in the UK, many schools don't have a technical person on site anymore. I know a lot of our secondary schools, they have a technician who is generally trained to do things that are, you know, electrical and, you know, change light bulbs and things like that, but they're not a computer technician as such. There's a tech support center somewhere else in another building in the town or in the next town. And, you know, if we're proposing BYOD strategies, then what happens when somebody shows up with a Kindle Fire, or even what happens if somebody shows up with a a black rectangle tablet with no badges on it from anywhere, you know, that they got for this price at this dodgy shop somewhere in the town, and it won't connect to the Wi-Fi, or it, they can't install Chrome on it or something like that. I think that's potentially incredibly difficult, because if you think about it, I know many schools in the US don't have school uniform, but in the UK, school uniform is a pretty common thing in a lot of schools. And one of the biggest arguments for school uniform was always that if you let kids bring in whatever clothes they wanted, then the rich kids would be in showing off with their fancy clothes, and the poor kids would feel left out, or kids would get picked on because they didn't have the right clothes. And I find it interesting and also a little strange that the people who are arguing for BYOD strategies in schools, they're arguing, you know, for the exact opposite of that equality agenda that we talked about with clothes, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago when I was at school. They're arguing for the exact opposite of that in schools with technology. And they're saying that it would be perfectly acceptable if the rich kids brought in their iPad 3 and the poor kids got whatever junk the school could afford. I'm personally uncomfortable with that. I think that's a very difficult thing to justify.
Well, and I think if BYOD is, let's say you've got a school board that says, look, we're going BYOD, make it work. I think you've got to have an approved list of devices where you can say, look, it's either going to be iPad 2, iPad 3, this Motorola or this Android tablet or this tablet. And you've got to have a limited list, and that allows IT to train themselves on how to support those, research issues, but also so you don't have the situation where you have one kid with an iPad 3, 64 gigabyte, and you have the other kid with the $40 knockoff tablet that barely connects to the internet. Mm-hmm. And then again, that goes back to what is the teacher supposed to do at that point? You've got some kids with Dropbox and Evernote, and you've got the other, you know, a couple other kids that barely have a browser.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that, you know, what we found with our 2 years on the iPad is that there are so many great applications that you can use for all kinds of teaching purposes. But if you have some kids on one platform, some kids on another, then you can't use any of that. All of that's off the table. The main reason why people like these mobile devices, all these great apps, and I'm not just talking about iOS, I'm talking about I guess there are some good ones in Android as well, but most of those are also in iOS. But these powerful native experiences that people can have, all of that's off the table because you don't have the same ones here and here. And okay, if you can limit it to two platforms, then maybe you can get your teachers to understand that they want to do this, so they say this to the iOS half of the class and they say this to the Android half of the class. But, you know, I'm not sure you can bring along every single teacher in that kind of agenda. I think that is going to be very, very difficult. Well, and at the end of the day, is going on the web the highest possible use of computers in the classroom? I don't think it is.
Well, look at your situation with the rollout you've had with iTunes U. In a BYOD situation, it just couldn't happen because there's no web-based client. There's no Mac-based client. It is on the iPad.
Yeah, and let's say you could be a school going for Google Chromebooks and basing your whole strategy in Google Docs. And that's a perfectly good way to do it as well. But the thing is, if you then bring in some kids on iPad and you go, well, okay, you guys get the crappy experience because you're on iOS and the kids on the Chromebooks get the good experience, that's not going to fly either. Because here's the thing, right? The world, and by the world I mean the general mass market of computing, is going vertically integrated. Right, Apple's always been vertically integrated. They've always had Apple computers, Mac OS, and Apple's online services. And now we've got iOS, iOS devices, and iCloud. But look at what's happening in the rest of the market. Google have always had their Google App services, their cloud services. They've got their operating system, Android, and they have got their cloud services. But now they've also bought Motorola. So now they're going, you know, services, device, operating system. Amazon cloud services, Amazon device, Amazon's fork of Kindle Fire. Look at Microsoft, Windows 8, Microsoft Surface, and Microsoft Office 365. Right? This is the way the market is going. And I think that in 2012, the worst possible strategy you could have, I don't believe, I never have said this, that every school should be on iOS. I don't believe that. But what I do believe is that one school should be on one platform. and you should leverage that to the hilt. And I think that is where schools should be looking these days. And I don't care if you choose Windows. I mean, a lot of schools, let's face it, a lot of schools are going to choose Windows 8 because that's what they know, right? But once you do that, you can leverage the whole stack and get a really good experience. You go Chromebook, you get a really good experience. You go iOS, you get a really good experience. But if you have to support iOS, Android, Kindle Fire, and something else, then you've basically thrown a boat anchor at the back of your speedboat.
Well,
because you can't actually use those ecosystems, whether it be iTunes U or Google Docs or the Kindle Lending Library or whatever it is.
You make a decision, and then you just go full tilt. Yeah. And just buy in, and that's where you've got to do a ton of research ahead of time. You've got to research the heck out of what you're going to do, but then just go full tilt. Let's say, again, this is probably out there, but let's say you're using Evernote, even though Evernote's a great application. Well, their various apps are at various stages on various devices. So let's say a new feature comes out that only works on the iPad, and you think this answers all my problems. This is the perfect solution for problem X. But again, if you've got a class full of half iPads and half Kindle Fires, you can't use that until the Kindle Fire application is updated.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you have perhaps had the misfortune to choose a platform that has not been very successful, then you're in a lot of trouble. You know, if you've got the WebOS tablets in your classroom or something, you know, that's going to be difficult for you. But a lot of people who are involved in educational technology, they have this phrase that they use a lot, which means they say, you know, it's not about the device. And I think one of the things that, I don't know about you, but I certainly get this thrown back at me quite a lot, is that I'm just pushing iOS because I think iOS is fancy, or I'm an Apple guy or whatever. But that's really not my line of thinking at all. But what I do believe is that it's at least a little bit about the device, right? Because if you pick the wrong device, then that choice is going to crucify you for every single year until you get to the end of your contract on whatever lease you do. And I think there is a role for somebody to analyze the technology and understand it completely and know what each technology can do for you. But then somebody's got to show some leadership and just make a choice. And I made this comment on Twitter last week and got a bit of heat for it, but I said that I really believe that bring your own device is a bit of a cop-out, that it's a bit of a failure of leadership where nobody can actually make a technical decision and stand behind it and justify it and also take the heat for when that choice is bad. I mean, I've had situations even in the past couple of weeks where I've chosen technologies. I chose the technology, and it turned out not to be very stable in the first iteration. And I took a lot of heat for that in school. But that's the job, right? That is the job that we are charged with doing, is making technical choices, standing behind them, making them work as best we can. And then if something goes wrong, you've got to stand up and be counted on that as well.
Well, you'd rather be wrong and make a decision than not make a decision at all and just make it the wild, wild west.
I think so. And I'm really concerned about BYOD as a, you know, the completely uncontrolled model of BYOD, where you bring in anything you like and we will make it work. Because I do believe that there is a cost to getting technology right in school. And BYOD appears to hold out a promise of getting all those benefits with paying none of those costs. And I don't believe that happens, because what happens is you put together lots and lots of things that almost work. You get something that approaches working as your effort goes towards infinity. And I think that's the thing where that is going to break BYOD strategies, is that either there'll be some teachers who don't go along with it at all, or everybody will just find it so much effort to actually properly integrate these things in a valuable way that it will eventually break up. Either that, or everybody just will use it to go on the web and that will be the end of it.
Well, and
it'll just be digital textbooks.
I think, you know, the promise of BYOD was that it would kind of create all this free time for IT, that people would take care of their own device. They would bring their own tablet in and they would take care of it. And all the school really had to do was create user accounts for whatever service they were using, provide the internet access, and then IT was done. But it's not that way. If a 12-year-old kid brings an iPad to school and can't get on the internet or can't get his apps to update, they're going to come talk to IT, and IT is going to be responsible for helping them. And so you know, in a perfect world, everybody would bring the same iPad and then they would take care of it all themselves in a perfect world. But that's just not the, the reality.
And certainly, I mean, the thing with, you know, saying it's not about the device, that it doesn't then follow that every device is equally good. There are some devices that are just very badly built. You know, there are certain releases of certain operating systems that are just not good. You know, there are certain drivers, there are certain ROMs you can download from the internet and flash onto your devices if you jailbreak your iOS device. You know, it's not even just that your people are going to be running with the vanilla versions of the sanctioned platforms, but you also have the possibility that people may have jailbroken, may have downloaded custom Android ROMs from the internet, and you've got all of those things to deal with as well. It starts to feel intractable, and we've only been talking about this for 50 minutes, and I'm starting to feel my blood pressure go up already.
Well, I had a situation a few weeks ago where I had I think I mentioned before, I do some moonlighting for our church as well. Our school is a part of a church, and I handle their IT as well on the side. They don't have as many devices to take care of. Well, I had an employee call me and say, "Hey, the wireless is not working where I'm at." Of course, that's a red flag for me. So I immediately, as soon as I can, I run down there and say, "Oh, wait a minute, your computer's online. I thought you said the wireless was not working." And he said, "Well, I got my iPad here that's not getting on the internet." And well, he just didn't know how to do it. He didn't know how to get the settings and Wi-Fi and click join, you know, the staff network. And so I thought, here's an example of where BYOD doesn't work. We provide him a laptop that he brings his iPad in that he wants to use and check his work email on. But then when he doesn't know how to get on the Wi-Fi, he calls me and tells me there's a problem. Well, there's not a problem. Our wireless is working. And so I think the people that love BYOD in a lot of situations are the ones that think, well, everybody will just figure it out on their own, but they won't. And then it creates more of an issue for everybody else.
Yeah, it feels very difficult to me. I think there's certainly scope for doing something where it could be bring your own iPad. I mean, or I say iPad as a proxy for any common device, but I mean, we have some kids right now who, you know, we've given them the iPad 1 and their parents have bought them an iPad 2 at home, let's say. And is there a compelling reason why I can't let them bring their own iPad into school? I mean, there are certainly complications with getting the right apps on it and so on. But, you know, let's imagine that those can be finessed away with volume purchase or something. There's not really a good reason why I couldn't let somebody bring in another iOS device into school. But if somebody wanted to bring in a Kindle Fire or an Android device and start to actually use that and expect that the teacher integrate that platform into their planning the same way as they're planning on top of iOS, I think that would be somewhere I'd have to push back pretty hard. I mean, there was a report, Oklahoma State University did a pilot with with iPads over a couple of classes. And what they found in that report, and they recommended full deployment of iPad across the university, but what they found in that report was that as well as student satisfaction and student self-reporting much greater engagement with the learning and so on, they also said that one of the things that was very beneficial for their faculty was that there was one device, one consistent hardware and software platform that the teachers could plan that would be available to everybody and they could really build learning and activities and so on top of that platform. And I think the more different elements you introduce into that foundation, the shakier that foundation becomes.
That comment made me think about the Promethean issue we've been having. And in my frustration, I sent my vendor an email that said, maybe we didn't choose the smart device or something of that nature, and making a reference to smart boards. And I was very frustrated. And then I thought, what would it look like to change? We would have to uproot all of our, we have a lot of content that we've built over the years for the Promethean boards that take advantage of the Promethean board. And there's a huge cost to trying to switch that. And just as if you're a teacher trying to build some compelling content, when you add these other devices, it creates a lot of complexity. And so you end up, again, we say that you end up going just back to the web because it's kind of the lowest common denominator. And, you know, it's just like there's no one, I don't think there's anyone that would argue that a native app experience is not tenfold better than a web app experience. And to me, that's a perfect analogy. That's the advantage of choosing a device and going with it. And I think what you mentioned about Chromebooks, it's very accurate because people will probably often call us both Apple fanatics, and that's true. We both love Apple, but I could argue in certain situations, Chromebooks paired with Google Docs is a powerful, powerful device.
Absolutely. You know, I have always been clear, you know, I talk about one-to-one and I talk about experience with the iPad a lot, and I'm always, I always try to be clear. Maybe I don't always do it, but I'm always trying to be clear that it's the one-to-one that's the most important part and not the iOS. I mean, I do believe that the iPad is the first education computer worth criticizing, to paraphrase Alan Kay from years ago. But if you offered me shared iPads in my school or one-to-one Chromebooks, I would bite your hand off for the one-to-one Chromebook straight away, because I know that one-to-one is the really the thing that brings the real power into the classroom.
Yeah, I could argue that as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just going to say, you were talking about content there, and something I've actually been thinking about quite a lot over the past couple of days is about content curation. I've been asked to do a track at a conference next year, and the track I have to design and deliver is about digital content curation, so which is something I've kind of been digging my head into a little bit over the past little while. And, you know, content curation, there are different sort of levels of longevity that you might want to create content over. And I think, you know, if I say this, people could throw it back at me in a certain way, but, you know, I really like to keep my content in the most neutral format possible, which typically means text, PDF, web page, something like that. Now, that's because the content that I create, I hope, is going to be valid for the long term, right? Even when we use iTunes U, my best practices document in school says, don't type your class right into the iTunes U course manager. Write it in a document first and then copy and paste it in there, because that way that will last much longer. Students, on the other hand, typically you don't have to keep their content for many, many years to come. You know, kids will take a course, the course is done, and in many cases you can render their work into a standard format like PDF or JPEG. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm not going back to that in 10 years' time and spending a lot of time looking at some students' content. Those are short-term projects with short-term outcomes, whereas teachers and at the school level, you tend to curate over a much longer period. And I think there's definitely a conversation, maybe even a whole episode to be had in talking about content curation and, you know, what are the different requirements at different levels. And I think for students, the native experience, the high-quality user experience is incredibly engaging, and it doesn't matter too much if the content they make is in some kind of proprietary file format, because ultimately, you know, kids move on, and, you know, the stuff you make in primary school is not important when you become an adult. Whereas for teachers, I'm much more hesitant for them to dig into very esoteric applications, and I prefer them to keep it separate and then, you know, look at something like iTunes U or iBooks Author as an end point of distributing your content rather than as a place to create in the first place.
Yeah, because I don't think I'm about, I guess, 10 years out of high school, and I do not have a single paper that I wrote in high school, and nor, if I had it, would I care. Literally, if you write a paper for the fall semester, when you finish that class in December, you could kind of care less about that at that point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was just clearing some stuff out of my house yesterday, and I found several programming assignments that I wrote in university. And I was at university in 1996 to 2000. And whilst it was fun to kind of look back on the ones that I did pretty well in, which was only the programming ones, and the ones I did pretty badly on, which is all the formal logic ones, you know, I just, you know, I looked at them, had a nice memory, and then threw them all in the bin. You know, it doesn't matter to me that I don't have that data anymore. You know, so some data is very transitory, and it's also a very low value. I mean, this is another part of the security conversation, is that not every piece of data needs to be defended to the same extent. One of the concerns about BYOD and our cloud strategies like the ones that we employ is, well, you know, who's got the data? Who can get the data and stuff? And, you know, I keep saying this. I have sat in meetings where I've started with, you know, where does Weed Genie's PowerPoint presentation live? And we end up talking about MI5 and the CIA and what all these rules are to do with data security. And I just don't think all of these things have to live in the same world.
Well, I agree. And, you know, one of the things that kind of made me think about is Evernote. Going back to, it seems like that's been the topic of the conversation today. And I love Evernote. I do. But I also wish there was a better export function in some ways. Like if there was, I wish I could type in plain text in Evernote, and I wish I could export a note to a text file. I would probably write in Markdown, export that to text. Mm-hmm. And so while I think about that, and the nerdy side of me says, okay, I should just abandon Evernote, stick to Dropbox and Notation Velocity, and do everything in folders and text, and it be portable for the next 100 years. But by doing that, I limit myself from all the cool things of Evernote. There's a lot of great things about Evernote. We organize this entire show through Evernote by sending in emails into our stacks and notebooks. And so, and in reality, are any notes from this show relevant 5 years from now? Probably not.
No.
You know, even 3 months from now, does anybody care about our planning notes from episode 2? No. Do we care? Probably not. And so I kind of struggle with that, and I think I should just use the best technology as long as they have a decent export function. Like, let's go with that. And I've been, the app I use for journaling is Day One. I don't know if you've ever used that application.
I have.
And so I've been journaling about my son's, really his life this whole year. I started in January, and he was about 16 months old then. And I've been journaling really every day since then, even if it's just one sentence. Well, they've since added the ability to add in pictures, and I've been loving that feature as well, and being able to put in pictures, and it records the correct timestamp, and that's wonderful. But I also have a concern, like, how am I going to get this out? Because does day one exist 25 years from now when I would love to go back? And so they've got a plain text export option, which is great. But then I also thought about the pictures. And so I asked the developer, do you guys have any sort of export option for the notes with pictures? And I believe they're working on a save to PDF for those notes. Mm-hmm. That's perfect. It's not the most portable format, but it works.
I mean, it's not like you're going to, with one click, take it out of one application and perfectly recreate that experience in another application. That's just not how software works. We haven't figured out how to engineer software for the long term that works that way. But I think that the crucial point with all of these applications that are more than just plain text, and, you know, sometimes call these applications sort of structured databases, is that don't be naive and think they're going to last forever. Nothing is. I mean, I was just working in my Aperture database today, and that's full. That's got 30,000 images in a proprietary file format, which is Canon's RAW file format, in a proprietary database, which is Apple's Aperture database. And one day that's all going to go south, and I don't know what I'm going to do then, but the thing is, I know already that that will eventually happen, and there's a long time to think about it. You know, it's very rare that these things disappear overnight, but the problem is that you get into a situation where people delay and delay and delay thinking about it, and they keep patching things and keep running them, and eventually you just can't even buy a computer that you can transition to that will run that software.
That's why if an application has a mildly useful export function, I'll just go with it. Again, there are things about Evernote export function that I don't love, but it's good enough. And I don't doubt that I can get all of my data out of there, and with a few hours worth of work, have it recreated in another application. There's not going to be an import function to something else that's, as you said, perfect, but there's no reason to not take advantage of Evernote's usefulness today on the off chance that I don't have a perfect replication of my data 20 years from now.
Yeah, I agree.
Probably should definitely mention our sponsor this week if you want to take a sponsor break. DisplayNote has been our sponsor for the past few weeks, and we really appreciate them. They've been a great partner for us. Again, as Fraser mentioned, you can read more about them at DisplayNote.com. But they're an application that lets a teacher take everything they do on their Windows or Mac computer and stream it out to a connected device like an iPad, an Android device, or a laptop. On the receipt of that content, again, this is my favorite part of the application, a student can add their own notes, media, or annotations and save that content for later review. So, again, your situation where you're lecturing off of a PowerPoint or a keynote, you don't have to provide handouts over paper so they can take those home. They can actually save them right there through the application. In the collaboration mode, multiple devices can work together on the same content. And in the presenter mode, DisplayNote allows your tablet or your smartphone to be used as a wireless presenter tablet and lets you send private messages and to connected devices. A classroom license is only $695, and that's a one-time fee. and allows up to 40 connections. Now, if you're a district or an entire school that wants to look at DisplayNote, they do offer a site license, and you can find out more about that at displaynote.com.
It's another one of those meta platforms, something like DisplayNote.
Yeah, you know, again, I think about that, and I've read a lot of articles lately about people just living in plain text and in just the basic file format. And while I see that argument, I just think that they may be missing out on something.
I think so. You know, I totally understand why people think that way, and I have a lot of sympathy for it as well. And I certainly, before I adopted Evernote, that was the way I was working. Was everything was just, you know, a text file or a PDF in Dropbox. But I think what has kind of broken that down a little bit is just the move to mobile, you know. And there are some good applications that deal with that kind of situation. You know, there are apps that will sync to Dropbox and sync folders and so on. But I guess, you know, we live in a world of rich media. And I like the fact that I can do something like in Instacast, I can open that file in Evernote and save, you know, an MP3 right in Evernote or whatever, make a recording in Evernote if I'm at a conference or something like that, or use the camera just to snap something straight into Evernote. And you get some incredible power with that. Things like when with Evernote, you can have it, it will OCR your images, and then you can search the text in your images and so on, which is crazy powerful if you're working on a whiteboard. You just finish up your session, snap the picture of the whiteboard, and you're done. We should probably do a whole show on Evernote, actually. I have a friend who works in New Jersey, and his whole school is running on Evernote. His name is Bill Stites, and he is probably the preeminent guy for the use of Evernote in education. Maybe we should try and get him on the show.
Yeah, that'd be great. I was actually thinking earlier, if they offered like domain-based email, we could kill Google Apps in a lot of ways. You could just, yeah. I mean, it's like it can do so much. Now, I think the biggest thing is it's mobile. I mean, you can throw something, you can throw a PDF, some text notes, an Excel document, all into one Evernote notebook, and then it's with you wherever you go. Mm-hmm. We're looking at, for our church, we're looking at some additional campuses. So I have all the quotes from the networking gear we'd need, and they're right in my phone. The vendor sent them to me as an Excel spreadsheet. I threw that into an Evernote notebook, and I can view that from wherever I am. And it just, you kind of can't beat the collaboration of it.
Yeah. They should sponsor our show.
They should. They absolutely. They should. Do you think we'll ever get to a place, you know, again, if it's, let's say this BYOD trend continues, but maybe we have a situation where it says you have an approved list of devices. So, you know, let's say at my school, we said we're going to do a one-to-one program, but you must bring an iPad 2 or an iPad 3. And that was for teachers and for students. So the parents just paid for it for their students. But for our teachers, we actually, you know, instead of actually providing them with a laptop or an iPad, that we gave them a stipend every 2 years to go buy a new iPad. And they were in charge of it. The only thing the school was in charge of was providing network access. Do you think we'll ever get there in either the education environment or in the enterprise environment?
I think it's possible. I think it is possible. I mean, I always hesitate to say that, you know, certain technologies will never be good enough to do X, Y, or Z, because anybody who says that usually ends up looking like a fool pretty shortly afterwards. What we know right now, today in 2012, is that HTML5 is not an adequate platform to deliver a rich experience across all kinds of media. You know, and I was, like I said to you before we came on air, I was having a debate about this on Twitter this morning, and the person I was talking to said, well, you tell me what you can't do on a cross-platform basis. And I said, GarageBand. And I said, well, that's predictable. You know, I was like, well, come on, is it predictable or is it not? I mean, that's a valid tool that we use to do lots of different kinds of learning. You know, there are certain issues. When you build these meta platforms, you've got to build them off the native platform. And we've been through this once before with Java, haven't we? I mean, the promise of Java and Swing and all of that kind of stuff was that we were going to be able to have these applications that would run on any device and it would be wonderful. Truth of the matter was, it was pretty awful everywhere. The web has broken that to a certain extent, and the web has achieved, I mean, what the web has achieved is information access from anywhere. That's a solved problem, essentially. But what hasn't been solved yet is the web as an application platform, right? HTML5 is not as powerful as the Android toolkit, or it's not as powerful as Cocoa on iOS or whatever. I can see a day coming where the HTML5 will be as good as all of that, but that day's not here yet.
Yeah, that's true. And that was the promise of, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago. And I guess it's kind of like Flash is, you know, when will Flash be good on mobile? It was always very soon. And I guess it's the same thing with HTML5. When will it be up to a native app standards? Very soon, I guess, is what we've been hearing.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not cynical about HTML5. I think, you know, we're already in a better place on the web than we were a couple of years ago. You know, the Flash conversation is not something that we really have anymore. But the difficulty for HTML5, if it is a difficulty, is that the native platforms are getting better very fast as well. You know, they're not standing still either. And it's not just a matter of waiting for HTML5 to catch up with native, but native is moving ahead pretty fast too. And I mean, we were talking in the week where iOS 6 came out, and there was a massive brouhaha about the new Apple Maps application. Now, you can get Google Maps as an HTML5 application on your iPhone today. And if that was good enough, there would be no problem. But people are going, no, oh, it's on the web, and I don't like it. You know, so there is clearly still massive demand for native experiences, even where you can get the exact same data set wrapped up in an HTML5 application on the same device. That's still not considered good enough for most people.
You know, one other thing about BYOD and this whole thing I was thinking about is from a finance and accounting perspective. You know, I've had a lot of emails lately about webinars about how investing in technology can help lower your tax liability.
Mm-hmm.
And do you, you know, in a BYOD situation, you don't always have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a stipend, and again, I'm not a finance person, so I don't know, but I'm sure a stipend is looked at differently than actually buying a device directly for somebody.
Mm-hmm. And that can have tax implications for the individual as well.
I mean, we've talked about that with applications.
Before. Yeah.
If I'm gifting someone, again, for an application that's $2, it's one thing, but if I'm gifting someone Final Cut 10
mm-hmm.
Through the volume purchase program, and that's tied to their Apple ID, you know, is that taxable income?
And you know the tax system moves so fast that I'm sure they're right on top of that already.
Right. You know, so, you know, speaking of iOS 6, you know, as we, I guess, get near the end of the show, there are some new MDM capabilities for iOS 6 that I'm sure a lot of your MDM providers will implement soon. I'm going to put this as a link in the show notes. A couple new things that are in iOS 6. You can disable a shared photo stream. You can block recent contacts synchronization. You can disable Passbook while the phone is locked or the iPad is locked. You can disable diagnostic info submission to Apple. Of course, the guided access, as we've talked about recently.
Mm-hmm.
You can set the wallpaper for a device, which I think is pretty cool, that if you wanted to have a uniform background or something, you could actually control that. You can disable iMessage. You can disable the iBook Store. Disable Game Center. You can do a global HTTP proxy, and then you can restrict manual configuration profile installation. So I don't know a situation where you'd want to do this, but you could keep someone from installing the test flight configuration profile for an application beta test, something of that nature. But that's just some of the new things that are in iOS 6, and I'll put that into the show notes.
I think the most interesting one in that whole list is the global HTTP proxy, because what that does is it provides a way for schools to deliver filtering no matter where the device goes. It's not immediately obvious to people that that's what that means, but my understanding of that feature is that the device will use that proxy regardless of which network it is actually on. So the way I'm thinking of experimenting with this, and I'm going to try and set up a test device soon to figure this out, is can I install maybe Squid on an Amazon Web Services EC2 instance and just make that my filtering for the whole school, regardless of where the device goes. So when an iPad goes home, it's still talking to my Squid proxy cache somewhere on the internet. I guess, you know, that's another extension of our kind of philosophy, I guess, that we're kind of coming to, which is that you put the services outside the school so they're accessible from everywhere. So can we actually deliver filtering as a service on something like EC2 using that global HTTP proxy from anywhere the device goes to? I've yet to sit down and work out that all, but that's my thinking around that feature.
Yeah, after the bullet note on this website I'm reading, it says force all traffic, internet traffic, through a proxy server. So I don't see why you couldn't do that mm-hmm. just by reading it. So looks like a good group of services from iOS 6. Now that guided access is going to be neat for a key. Let's say, for example, your lunch menu program where you order what you wanted for lunch at the beginning of the cafeteria was, an iPad app. It's where you could limit people from actually leaving the application. So that's a pretty neat application.
Yeah. I mean, I had a little play with guided access recently just after iOS 6 came out, and it's not just that you can prevent them from leaving the application, although you can do that, but it also, you can prevent them from going to other parts of the application. Now, a good example of using this would be, we did a number of digital exams last year, and we used an application called PDF Expert on the iPad to fill in the PDF forms and then print out the application. But what gated access would let you do is it would let us, instead of having to set up spare iPads, which is what we did, like quarantined iPads that were erased before the exam, what we would be able to do then is put the exam paper on the pupil's own iPad, put their iPad into gated access mode, and lock out many, many features of the application, and then they could actually sit the exam, and then it would require an administrator passcode to get back out of that mode. So that would save, because nobody can afford to have, if you had like 30 kids doing digital exams, you couldn't afford to have 30 spare iPads sitting there for 1 week a year. But gated access would actually let us do that with the pupil's own iPad as well.
Have you had any of your students asking about why they can't update to iOS 6?
I prepared the ground for that beforehand. So, guys, you've heard about this announcement. Sorry, but you're going to have to suffer for 6 months. I mean, what was quite nice about it was that most of the applications that we were using still work on iOS 5. I mean, one of the things that we've sometimes seen when iOS updates come through is that there's a version of iWork that goes through a so-called trapdoor update, where if you update the version of iWork, you have to go up to the latest version of the OS. And there was a 1.62 update to the iWork suite on the same day as iOS 6 came out, but it did not require iOS 6. So I can take that update and I can put it on our iPads as well, which is quite helpful.
I found that updating all of our iPads to iOS 6 through Apple Configurator was very fast. And when I went, after I got on iOS 5, I did the over-the-air updates, but I was able to plug up 6 iPads at a time to Apple Configurator through a powered USB hub, and I only had to download the OS one time, mm-hmm. and it was able to do it quickly. I had nearly 40 iPads done in probably an hour or so, and it's working well so far. Mm-hmm. A lot of our apps have already updated, and the ones that we have to have, we're all working on it. I had tested those ahead of time, and it was relatively painless. I only had one that failed, and I don't know why, and I got in touch with Apple about how to manage that with the volume purchase applications, because when we had talked about that, what happens if you lose one or one breaks, what happens to those app licenses, and it was stuck at the DFU screen, the disk firmware utility screen, I think is mm-hmm. the acronym, and they told me they said to just go ahead and wipe it and then make it as a new device, and if you run into issues with your application licensing, we'll basically take care of you. And so I wiped it, went into iTunes and restored it, and then put it into Apple Configurator, and it acted like it was going to take those licenses. It would need fresh ones, but then it did it all and didn't ask for them. So I don't know if they got some sort of mechanism to tell that was the same device.
I think it's key to the serial number or the UDID of the device or something. The nightmare scenario is actually if you destroy the piece of hardware and then you have to bring in a new piece of hardware, and then it won't recognize that as being the device that used to have those licenses.
I think just the idea of buying 2 to 3 extra licenses of every application, unless it was an app that was $300 per license, for the apps that are $2 to $3, it just makes life a little easier to have a couple of spare ones.
Yeah, always a couple of spares. That's how we roll.
I guess that's all I have. Anything else you have?
That's all for me.
Well, again, thanks for DisplayNote for sponsoring the show this past week. Again, DisplayNote.com, and there will be a link in the show notes. I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers, app.net, at at Bradley Chambers, then on the web at chambersdaily.com.
And I'm spears.org for my blog, Fraser Spears on Twitter, FS on app.net. And I guess we'll see you next time.
Have a good week.